Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Coaches, before the podcast, I wanted to let you know there is a new video available at bivideoproductions.com. Learn the tagging up system with Aaron Fern at www.aaronfernbasketball.com or at bivideoproductions.com. As the concept of the tagging up has become more popular, take this opportunity to learn how to improve your offensive rebounding and transition defense from Aaron Fern, the innovator of this system, who has used it at the professional and youth levels. Go to www.aaronfernbasketball.com. That's AAronFearne basketball.com. Now let's get to the podcast. Coaches, real treat today. We have John Patrick, who has been 22 years in the professional coaching ranks, and he's currently head coach of MHP Reason Ludwigsburg since 2013, where he has twice been named Easy Credit BBL Coach of the Year. And in 2017-18, he was named Basketball Champions League Best Coach. Coach, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
Well, we could do a whole podcast on your background. And as you know, we don't really do that, but you played at DeMatha for Morgan Wooten. You played it for Stanford for Mark Montgomery. So great background there in terms of coaching. But 22 years has definitely been a great life in professional coaching. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, I feel really lucky to have been in basketball so long. I actually sat on the bench for Morgan Wooten, but I learned a ton from being there. I was the 16th man on a 16-man team with five NBA players, and I've had a great run so far, and I'm super lucky to have been coaching for 22 years.
Well, beyond that, coaches may be wondering, I mean, you coach in one of the most fascinating leagues in Europe by far, and we've talked about that a few times on this podcast, just how interesting the German league is, especially from a coaching perspective, and you're one of the main reasons why. And we're going to get into that a little bit on the defensive side and talking about pressure and some of the different things that you've used that traditionally aren't used as much at the professional level. But I want to start with one of your quotes, which is basically defense is about heart and hustle, but it is also about concentration and priorities. Most bad players define defense incorrectly. I love this phrasing. So my question to you is, how as a coach do you help them to define defense correctly?
Yeah, that pretty much puts our defense in a nutshell. And it's a good question. And it's a question that we have to redefine and tweak each season, because we do want to make other teams uncomfortable. We do want to disrupt, but we want to be disciplined. And so what we try to do is it starts with recruiting. We have to reload our team each year, probably similar to a JC sort of a situation where you have just guys coming and going. We know we have guys for one season, but we're a low-budget team. It was the same situation for me at Göttingen, and we need to be competitive 5 weeks after we first meet. So we have 5 weeks to get our acting gear and play preseason games and get guys in shape who aren't in shape. And that's why recruiting is so important, getting guys that maybe get it a little bit and then work with them and try to be successful with guys that are hungry and can do some of the things that we need them to do. And by that, I mean, you can't have slow-footed seven-footers on the court and pressure defense, move your feet in front of a guard-dominated opponent. So to make a long story short, our philosophy is that we disrupt with discipline. We try to take the ball out of certain guys' hands, ball handlers' hands. We're a low-budget operation. We've been super successful playing small ball, and I've pretty much brought that to Germany in the second league, where we played with young German kids and a couple of American 5'9" guards and dominated the league. But if I get guys on my team who allow me to coach them and want to work hard and are proud of playing defense and hustle. It's a ton of fun, but there are always challenges. And then, you know, there's always guys where things are new or a lot of nuts to crack. And sometimes it's not so smooth, but we usually get going in stride in February or March into our groove. And we were on that groove this year too. And it's a lot of fun to see guys come together and play against big names and, yeah, just function on the court with the system.
Well, it's great stuff. I've enjoyed watching your team and getting to know a little bit of the philosophy behind it. And we're going to get in and dive a little bit deeper into some of those different areas that you mentioned, including recruiting and talent identification, which is so important. But just kind of a little bit more on the defensive side, someone who's a really good friend of mine, who's observed your league and that watched your team quite a bit, he said that one thing that stands out to him is that it's very high intensity with high level of detail on defense, which is a difficult combination, isn't it? Like, there's no fake hustle. This is high level of intensity with incredible detail. How do you develop that within practice?
So I guess that's the focus of our practice from day one. And I have to thank, even though I've never met him and he doesn't know who I am, but I played for a coach who played for Rick Pitino. In, I believe it was 1974, it was in the early 70s, at the University of Hawaii, where Rick Pitino took over. And my coach played, and they played this system way, way back. And it was a system. And so I played for this guy when I was 26, Patrick Ryan. And when he told us we were a smaller group in Japan, a smaller team, fairly low budget team. We had two American guards. We're playing against teams that had two ex-NBA centers and national team players. And he said, from day one, we're going to press the hell out of other teams. And it sounded like fun and free and wild. And we're like, oh, okay, we're going to, that sounds like fun. And from day one, it was drill after drill after drill to perfect the details. And he kept saying, it's not gambling. It's a system. It's not a half court system. It's a full court system. And so we had rules for screens. We had rules for running and jumping. We had rules where your hands were. We had rules for communication. And I think a lot of high school, college teams have rules. But as you said, the amount of detail and the amount of just discipline on the full court that's necessary to play good, solid, I would say solid full court defense, you have to have your brain turned on the whole time and you're going to get tired. So you need more than five people who can do this.
Well, and it shows obviously that you're doing those things. And so I'm right. Like, there aren't many coaches that are pressing at the professional level. And I know you're not necessarily 40 minutes all the time now with this team. Is that right? But you've done that in the past where you've gone full 40 minutes of pressing. Can you talk about why, you know, beyond this obvious part, what are the goals of this? I mean, traditionally coaches think pressing is turnovers, pressing is disruption, all these different things. But what are some of the other goals that maybe we haven't thought about?
Yeah, I may say some obvious things here, but as a low budget team, you pay for experience when you get your players. You pay for every inch or centimeter of height. So it's usually costs more to get bigger, talented, skilled guys. And there are a bunch of hungry, athletic, 6 feet, 6'1", 6'2", 6'3", guys who don't really play a position, but they can ball, they can play. And some of them are really athletic and can be good in a full court system, but need some fine tuning. It's just a lot easier and cheaper to recruit shorter guys and more athletic guys that give us a chance to win rather than try to follow the same style as Bayern or Alba or a higher budget team that if we tried to get the same type of players, we would have so much lower quality. And so our mismatches are going to be in our favor, are going to be quickness mismatches on offense and defense, and that we double team and that we make the court small. Yeah, there's no rest. So our advantage is going to be our legs and our pace. And we had the highest pace, or have had the highest pace, not only in Germany, but in Europe, a few of the last 12 seasons since I've been here. And we did that in the second league in a pro league with basically high school kids, and dominated it. And so you definitely need the right guys, but you can disrupt. The flip side of it is if you play with a high pace, you have to take care of the ball. So you're banking on an advantage with conditioning. You're banking on an advantage with possessions, where you need to have a system for offensive rebounding too, and safety on the fast break defense. And you just can't gamble. You can't give other teams good shots. And so actually statistically, some things look whacked because we're usually tired, but the other team, so our field goal percentage is not great. Our 3-point shooting percentage is never great, but our opponents are worse, you know. But if you look over the season and you look at other teams' field goal percentage and 3-point percentage, usually we're not that great because we're playing and it's such a helter-skelter pace. But we've had the lowest turnover with this pace. We've still had the lowest turnovers, not only in Germany, but also in first leagues in Europe for several years in the last decade. And we were also this year, we had less than 10 turnovers per game, which I was really proud of. So it's not that the high pace can help us. It's the high pace with discipline and with the right guys and being conservative despite playing a high pace.
Well, you keep saying the right guys, so let's just jump right to there. Because again, like, recruiting is so important and talent identification is so important. You talked about budget and all these different factors into it, and also finding guys that will accept and play this way, because it may not be the typical style from the professional level. But what struck me when you shared a list of kind of some of the things that are factors in you evaluating players is how many of those factors were about character, conduct, body language, ability to play within a system, relationship with teammates, on-court behavior, that these things were so prevalent in that list of evaluating a player. Can you talk about the importance of character when it comes to your system specifically?
Sure. Well, first of all, I have to give credit to, especially to Morgan Wooten and Mike Bray and Eddie Saw, my high school coaches, and Coach Montgomery at Stanford, because they also emphasized character all the time. And with the basketball that we want to play, with this up-down, which is fun, up-down, and with a lot of creativity on offense, but a lot of rules we're following, it's going to test your character. You're going to be tired. You're going to have oxygen debt. We're going to practice really hard. We're going to try to push our opponents to the limit. And we all know when we're tired, sometimes it's difficult to have our best behavior. You know, you get emotional. It's always a challenge to keep the balance between the positive emotions and emotions of positive energy. And then what happens if you just trying your hardest, playing your hardest, and things don't go well. And so I do believe that basketball at a high level is 90% attitude. And seeing coming from Washington, D.C., and having played professionally and coached professionally, and I've seen so many guys not make it because of their attitude or because of their emotional approach to the game, over-emotional approach to the game. I've seen a bunch of guys make it because of their attitude, just guys who keep getting better. Same goes for coaches, people who don't put their head down. And so Coach Wooten, one of the first things we did at basketball camp, not when I got to high school, but when I went to his camp as a 10-year-old, Jack Bruin, who coached at Carroll High School at the time, and Coach Wooten and Mike Bray, and they gave us a list of things that coaches look at when they come into a gym to recruit high school players, what college coaches are looking for. And these were all intangible attitude things, how a guy gets along with his teammates, his body language, how he reacts to a referee's call, how he reacts after a good play, how he reacts after he makes a turnover, his teammate makes a turnover. So all these things come at the base of what a guy's comfort zone is. Just generalize and say guys that have a really small comfort zone probably going to have a tough time playing for me and probably going to make me crazy too. And guys who have been coached or just have a general character where they're going to try to get better, or they're going to accept criticism, or they're self-critical and they enjoy playing, they have a better chance of doing well, regardless how athletic they are, how tall they are, how good, how well skilled they are.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool that that connects all the way back to your time as a camper at a camp. And it just shows, again, the impression that a coach can make on you. Now, you mentioned this in terms of recruiting a little bit, but when putting together an aggressive defensive team, the ideal combination is size and movement together. But if given one, do you prefer movement over size?
Yeah, I think especially now that other teams have kind of copied what we've done, now that there are more teams that are playing small ball, and I mean, heck, the Chris Fleming had PJ Tucker playing a little center against us. What was that, 9-10 years ago in the German league, and now PJ Tucker's playing center in the NBA for the Houston Rockets. Things have developed, but for sure, in a full court system, you need guys that can move. You need guys who can stand their ground. But we have played in the past with it's not really about centimeter height. It's playing big with small guys who can play big. Charles Lee is an assistant coach for the Milwaukee Bucks right now, but he was a 6'3" shooting guard / point guard from Bucknell. And he came, played for me, I think it was 2008, 2009. And it kind of made his head spin the first couple weeks, but he was our power forward and often matched up with other teams' centers. And that kind of threw him for a loop at first, but as hard as it was for him to guard them, he was willing to play physical and was pretty strong to start out with, being 6'3" and stocky. But they couldn't guard him at all. And so I think he ended up having a lot of fun playing in our system for a season, and it was effective. So to make a short answer long, I think, yeah, it's much more valuable to have guys that can move, that can cover ground, and especially in a high pace where there's long rebounds and where you want to make your opponent uncomfortable for over the whole game and over the whole court.
Yeah, very cool. I think it was on your FIBA video that I heard you say that double team, it really is a team, you only double team 5% of the time, even though you're full court. You could be 40 full court the full game, but 5% of the time maybe it's a double team. Most of the other time it's just a stunt or a run and jump, right?
Right, run and switch. Yeah, exactly.
So the way that you phrased it to me was the goal should not be speculation, but rather conservative goals to turn over and remove the ball from the point guard's control. Can you talk about the different ways that you try and take the ball out of the point guard's control?
Sure. I can also tell you what a nightmare it was for me as a high school kid and as a point guard, as a 6'4 point guard, to have to play against quicker, smaller, more athletic, or just say teams with multiple smaller point guards and have to bring it up. Because in Washington, D.C., there were just teams that ran at you, so to speak. And so this wasn't fun, and it wasn't fun as a Stanford point guard playing against Ralph Miller's teams at Oregon State, where you had Gary Payton and a few other 6'3", 6'4", athletes trapping you and running and jumping, and sometimes not. Sometimes the worst part of it was when they didn't run and jump, because then you had to figure out how to get around somebody who was more athletic than you, which was tough. So part of the reason we do this is because of my personal experience being from DC and having played a lot of pickup ball. I was a gym rat, and knowing that in Europe it was kind of new, and having done it before and having it be successful, not only at the Matha, but when I went to Sidwell, and having played against teams that full court pressed, it's super uncomfortable if you're the only point guard. And even if you have two guards and the other team has four guys that are pressing, it's just a nightmare to see three of your teammates jogging down the court, you know, setting up in their half court offense, and you and your buddy have to figure out how to break the press. So this is again about the comfort zone and about, yeah, how many guys on another team are capable of bringing it down one-on-one. And then calculating from there, does it make sense to run and jump? Does it make sense to just wear them out? Does it make sense to trap? Figuring out where it's part of the fun of having a full court system is you don't always have to use it. And like you said, you don't always have to trap, but certainly it's a nice option to have.
So the point guard has to constantly worry because the threat is there of a trap, but there's also a threat of a run and jump. Are you doing different things to deny them the ball full court, even on entry too, or some type of disruption there?
Yes. So we have point guard deny. We have point guard traps. That means double teaming the point guard to get it out of his hands. Denying obviously means not letting him have it to start out with. We have stunts. We have let him bring it up to half court and then trap him. We have let somebody else bring him up and then deny the point guard. It really depends how athletic and how good and how deep another team is, whether we're going to get an advantage out of doing something or not. But it's been done to us too in seasons where we're not as strong, or my team's maybe not as strong at the point guard position, or if we have injuries or something like that, other teams might turn the tables and do it to us. And I'll be in just the same situation. There's nothing you can do. You know it's coming, but still it's a struggle. And that's also the fun of having it in our system having brought it to Europe. Is it looks like chaos, but it's not chaos. It's just a press, and somebody else has to do something that they're not that good at, which is bringing the ball up under pressure.
Yeah, and scouting report and different things like that play into this as well in terms of understanding who you want to try and disrupt, I imagine.
Yeah, for sure. It helps to have good video scouting and good personnel scouting in order to press.
The other thing that usually happens with a lot of pressing is there's a lot of subbing. Are you aggressive subbing as well?
Yeah, I am. Some of the people who work at the scorers tables kind of roll their eyes and take deep breath when I say hi to them before the game, like, not you again, because we sub like ice hockey teams. You know, we'll send three guys in at a time, and my teams have a rule, if you get tired, you can take yourself out. And I got this from Coach Wooten also. I thought it was great. I was so far down on the bench, I never benefited from this. But if you got tired, you could take yourself out, and then you could put yourself back in. But if Coach Wooten took you out, then he decided when you went back in. And I have that too, and it breeds trust, and it also just keeps fresh guys out there, which is a huge advantage. So we say give us two or three good minutes at a time. I had a young guy this year where 90 seconds he was grabbing his neck and telling me he couldn't breathe, so he was about 90 second rotation. But depends on how many stoppages there are, but the thing gets going up and down, and you're working hard on defense, and for sure 2, 3, 4 minutes and you need a break.
Of course, it would make sense, and it makes sense that there's some substitutions necessary to be able to maintain this for you and for your team. So the other part that's always curious to me about pressing teams is how coaches connect it to the half court defense. Do your priorities and rules stay connected? Do they stay the same? Your denial defense in certain situations, rotation, stunting, all that. Does that stay largely the same in the half court for you as well?
Well, I don't want to give all the secrets to the system, but I can say that there is a backcourt rule. There's a set of backcourt rules. And for me, the easiest way to do it is when you get in the front court, there's a completely different set of rules. So some of those rules are, say, fluid, but when you cross half court, and especially with a 24-second shot clock, you need to, when you get in scoring range, you have a different philosophy and a different way to do things. So I'm much more like Tony Bennett, or I would like to be, let's say that. I would like to be conservative pack defense, you know, making walls. And even though we're smaller physically, height-wise, be a very solid, good tracing team in the half court. Whereas if you saw us in the full court, if you saw the first 5 seconds of the defense, you might say, damn, these guys are wild. But there's a different purpose in the back court as there is in the front court.
Well, it speaks to the opportunities too, that what you farther away from the basket your opponent is, the more risk you can take. The closer they get, the less risk you can take is really the theory that you're trying to apply.
Well, we don't want to take risk in the backcourt, but there's certain things that we want to do. Like we talked about, you know, whether we want to run and jump, or, you know, who we want to handle the ball. You can't do that stuff. And I won't do it in the front court because it's gambling. You're one pass away, one quick pass away from giving up an open shot. So we still want to be solid in the backcourt, but like I said, it's a different set of rules. And given the other team's 7-footer, the ball 80 feet away from the basket's not going to hurt you. And in fact, it'll help you and let him make some decisions bringing the ball up the court. But you can't do that in the half court and let the 7-footer, you know, catch it 3 feet from the basket.
Hey, coach, going to interrupt this podcast for a brief message from show partner, Simply Safe. With home security, there's two ways you can go about protecting your home. There's the traditional way, where you wait weeks for a technician to do a messy installation that costs a small fortune. Or there's the other way, Simply Safe. Simply Safe is everything you need in a home security system. It's award-winning protection, 2-time winner of CNET Editor's Choice Award. Simply Safe blankets your whole home in safety. You get comprehensive protection for your entire home. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. You barely notice it's there. But what's truly remarkable is you can set up this system all by yourself. Anyone can do it. It takes 30 minutes to an hour tops, and there's absolutely no trade-offs to your safety. You'll have an army of highly trained security experts ready to dispatch police to your home at a moment's notice 24/7. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. It's why The Verge calls Simply Safe the best home security system. Go to simplysafe.com/team today and you'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplysafe.com/team. That's simplysafe.com/team. Yeah, I loved your half-court phrasing, creating walls. The other thing I really liked is, and hopefully you can talk to me about closeouts, is one of the teaching points that I love and I totally agree with and I've always taught is that the emphasis on playing one-on-one defense first and adjust to team rules second. Can you talk about why and then maybe explain that just for coaches listening?
Sure. I think there are a lot of, and I've had coaches like this too, in my playing career, who said, you know, we want to push baseline or we want to push to the outside. And so you get used to pushing to the baseline, but in fact, in the game, you might be pushing a right-handed guy who can't go left. Because you're pushing him to his strong hand, or you're pushing a guy with a low release on a right-handed shot, you're not able to trace his shot because you're concerned about following your team rule of pushing baseline instead of forcing a guy that you're playing basically one-on-one against in a five-on-five situation. You need to contain this guy. You need to keep him from getting off, and instead you're giving him exactly what he wants individually because you're following your team rule. So it's a little bit contrarian thinking to some coaches and players. And I get college rookies coming in that just don't get it sometimes it's one day, sometimes it's 3 months. And then when they get it, they realize, oh yeah. When my guy catches it, you know, it's going to take a second for everybody else to jump to the ball. And so I'm alone. I'm on an island. I got to guard him one-on-one. And that's what happens in fast break situations. And that's what happens against teams that have good ball movement. You got to stop a guy one-on-one. And if you're worried about your team pick and roll rule and the guy rejects you and goes in, blows by you for a layup, didn't help that you knew what the team rule was.
Makes sense to me. It makes complete sense to me. The things sometimes we sacrifice when it comes down to the main thing, the first thing is stopping the ball. So coach, I want to get into some defending screen situations with you. Use your expertise through all the years and all the different influences that you've had to be able to talk about defending certain screens. I wanted to start with one of the common ones that I haven't talked about enough on the podcast, which is defending horns. Do you have some philosophies around defending horns type actions?
Sure. You know, without giving away all of the secrets or our way of analyzing, horns is a situation where the ball is in the middle of the court and there's a screen coming from either side. That means from the elbows, and it looks like longhorns or whatever. Most teams will put up the index finger and the pinky, and so it's called horns. But basically what it is it's a screen going from inside to outside. And so traditionally it was the other team's five guy and four guy setting it. And yeah, it's going to the one side. You have to have a strategy for what kind of players you're playing against. So, for example, against certain guys or against certain teams, it makes sense to stop the point guard, meaning to hedge him. And other teams, it would make more against other players, it would make more sense to fan the point guard or make him dribble more, keep the ball in his hands. This really depends on the opponent, but because it is a basic attack method, and even if you have some kind of smoke and mirrors, a lot of teams will use the horn set as their finisher after a couple of passes or after their initial motion. It'll get into a horn set. And I think what's important is to recognize if an opponent is a roller or a shooter. If a guy's a roller, you need to have a strategy. And if a guy's a shooter, you have to have a strategy, meaning the screen that the ball is coming off of. But we always have multiple coverages. And against good teams, if they know what's exactly coming, you're playing against a high-level team. We're playing against Bayern Munich, where the center is Greg Monro, and he's not only a good roller, he's also a very good banana popper and an excellent passer. You need to have a couple of coverages where you can switch it up, because if they know what's coming, they're going to pick you apart. And again, the key being to be conservative, to be in the half court, to be stingy and giving away contested shots, whereas in the full court, we would push the pace a little bit. Against Horns, you don't want to give up a one-pass shot, or you don't want to have the point guard or whoever has the ball turn the corner. So we're trying to avoid quick hits against our Horns or against Horns sets.
Well, and the reason I asked about Horns is because, and coaches, if you haven't checked this out, John Patrick has a individual defensive improvement video on the FIBA Basketball Fundamentals website. But in that video, you played 5-on-5 plus 2 versus Horns. And right. I love advantage drills in the sense that it stimulates decision-making, and that's kind of my jam. But coaches always ask me about defensive decision-making. And the things that you were doing out of 5-on-5 plus 2, in my opinion, yes, they're offensive decision-making drills, but they are big-time defensive decision-making drills. And can you talk a little bit about that in terms of maybe the 5-on-5 plus 2 and what you're trying to get out of it since it's on the FIBA site?
Sure. Again, I'd like to say that these drills, Sandro Gamba, who was the Italian Olympic coach, I believe in 84 and 88, I was lucky enough to be able to work with him. Coach Wooten loved disadvantage drills. Coach Montgomery loved disadvantage drills. The guy that Packy Ryan, who played for Patino, we would play full court scrimmages 5-on-4, and being one of the two Americans, I was always on the four-man team, and it was regular rules, and we had to press. And I think playing disadvantage scrimmages or disadvantage competitions makes you realize it's much, much more about hustle and making other teams make the extra pass and these basic things we talk about. But until you actually get out there at a disadvantage and win because you make your opponents uncomfortable with ball pressure and rotations and things like that, you don't believe it. So whether it's 5-on-4 or 5-on-3 plus 2 continuity drills, full court drills, or this 5-on-5 plus 2 half court drills, it's all the same stuff. Not getting beat 1-on-1. If you do get beat, the wall is there, or the rotation, the help is there, and helping the helper with hands up and communication and all that good stuff that coaches like to see. But it's really uncomfortable to do it at first and to believe it for guys and most college players. A lot of the German guys that I recruit too have never even done shell drill. So this is like a slap in the face to come in and have to do 5-on-4 scrimmages or 5-on-5 plus 2. But they get it and they see it, and it ends up being a real competition, and so it ends up being a fun way to compete and cover defensive elements in practice.
I loved it. And it's you know, I don't know exactly when that video was done, but yeah, I was curious and I'm glad you connected that for us about why you do it, because you know, it has lots of possibilities, especially again at the youth levels, developing players' ability to be able to make decisions and more importantly, read their teammates' decisions and learn how to cover for each other, which again, I imagine transfers for you in the full court a little bit with the pressing situations too.
It does. And we talk all the time about reading and reacting on offense. We don't talk enough about reading and reacting on defense, the defensive decision making that has to go on and being solid. But the main thing is just there's an upward spiral to being a good defensive team or to even to being a good a hard defense practicing team, and that is your offense has to be good to score. And if you go up against an opponent in a game who's not used to playing against your intensity, they're going to struggle. And if your team offensively is used to playing against the physicality and quickness and good rotations and hands up, and then the games are going to be fun. They're going to be more relaxing and more comfortable than the other team. So I like to talk, and again, it's like I'm speaking a foreign language during the first week of practice, because I talk about the upward spiral of defense and also the downward spiral of concentrating too much on offense, because you get comfortable and you think you're pretty darn good. Like what Coach Van Gundy said about being great 1-on-0 against the chair. Yeah, that's kill that chair 1-on-1. But if you go up against some good players and some quick rotating defenses in practice, you learn how to make decisions on offense too. So it does help your team get better in general.
No, it's great stuff. Coming back, I guess, to just some screens off the ball a little bit, can you talk a little bit about defending a stagger screen? Also something I've never talked about, never asked a coach. Do you have some strategies that coaches can think about defending stagger screens?
Sure. I mean, we've been really good some seasons. And even in the good seasons, we've had games where we weren't good against stagger screens. Some coaches use them a lot. Some coaches hardly use them at all. But it's something you have to be prepared at our level. You have to be prepared to play against floppy and staggers and gates, elevator screens. And so we can talk about it all we want, but you have to, in your orientation phase or in your preseason for us, what's 5 weeks, you have to go up against these formations. So I would recommend coaches not just to talk about it, or if we try to build up our defense in 3-on-3 situations, and we'll put a coach up top and we'll put a guy coming off a stagger and as a warm-up drill just to get used to it. And again, we'll have multiple strategies. Sometimes we'll chase, meaning chase from the outside. Sometimes we'll jam and cut the last screen, and if it's on the baseline, there's nowhere to flare. Sometimes we will switch the second screen. Sometimes we will hedge the second screen, and then the guy who set the first screen will be in the hole, so to speak, and we'll have to help. We can't just do the same thing every time against a team like Alba Berlin that runs floppy or staggered 40 times in a game, but we have to get used to it and get used to the terminology and have our base strategy, which would probably be to chase it. And the way that refs call hands, the referees are very detailed and very consistent about calling hands on screeners. Like Rip Hamilton would have shot 30 free throws a game if he would have played in Europe, because they call every touch when a guy's trying to come off. So you can't touch, but you got to be in his back pocket and you got to chase up. And then how you guard that first screen and how you guard that second screen, you need to have a base coverage, and then you need to have emergency coverages or a plan B if the first things don't work. Then there's stunting from the ball, and then there's what you do on your weak side in case it's a floppy action, because there's going to be options for the offense on the weak side as well.
Well, it's great. Even just you explaining that, there's A, B, and C, sometimes options that you have to go to within a game. Because I think we usually think about that relative to ball screen coverage with all the potential ball screen coverages. But when you're defending the level of teams that you're defending, that's such an important part. And will scouting report go in and dictate the coverage you go into a particular game with? But then what's happening? Like, what leads to you potentially changing?
It's a good question. I have had teams. My team with John Brockman here at the center was super intelligent team. We were DJ Kennedy, John Brockman. We had a kind of a bomb squad of undersized, really, really good players who could adjust on the move. So I wouldn't recommend getting too fancy. I don't want to reinvent the game. Like, we have our base, and if that base works, we're going to stick with that. If we're getting torched with something, I just want to be prepared. I want my guys to be prepared that they're not going to freak out if we say, okay, now we're switching the screen, or look, we're playing against a bunch of shooters, or we're playing against a certain type of one shooter and the rest penetrators, where we can make the adjustment and they believe in it, and then they attempt, even if it's not perfect, we're going to look like a unit on defense. So to answer your question, it's a little bit roundabout, but we're going to have our base, but we're also going to have practiced it. And my assistant coaches are so important. And right now I have a great assistant, Josh King, and our strength coach played for me for 4 years, David McCray, and they're ahead of me. When they see guys kind of stunned and thinking too much, they'll tell them, hey, just do it. We're working on our base. Don't think too much yet, and then we'll adjust it. It's so important to have assistants that get it, and have, say, your somebody else that with a different voice that has the same message, and players who one or two players is enough that they get it, so that the other guys will believe, because this doubt, oh my God, we're doing, we have 10 different things. I don't know what's going on. There's always going to be, for a moment, a little bit of doubt, and it's never going to be perfect, but having a strong base and having guys that are into it will allow us, or allow really good defensive teams to make adjustments.
Good stuff. And then in terms of handling scouting, so a lot of pressing coaches I've talked to in the past would kind of indicate that they don't do as much scouting because the press is going to take the offense out of a lot of their stuff anyways. But I'm imagining in your case, scouting is more important because, as you said, you have kind of different rules, front court, back court. Is that the case, that scouting, obviously at the professional level, I imagine it's important everywhere, but is it even more important because they have to adjust to the different rules in the half court?
Yeah, it is. You're right about that. And that would actually be a good topic for me to talk with some of my ex-assistants about, my assistants now, because we scout like crazy. We're, we have a very detailed scouting report, and sometimes I think we might be wasting time, because sometimes the press does take care of a lot of these imperfections in the half court. But the thing is, we're aiming to win even against the top teams and teams that are more talented than us and bigger and have budgets that are 10 and even 20 times more than us. And we have to feel prepared. And so we have to know what their go-to sets are, what their finisher, we talked about horns, what their finisher plays are. We have to know what elements and how they want to get things done, so to speak. And then it makes it almost a relief if the press works, because then we don't have to get into it. But against good teams, they're going to be able to beat the press. Like I said, Bayern or Alba, or this year, every year it's different teams. When we played internationally, we played against a lot of national team players and ex-NBA players and former whatever, all ACC college players. And it didn't matter when the other team's coaches were well prepared, our press didn't do a whole lot to bother them over a long period of time. Maybe we got a couple extra possessions, which is all in the end where we want to get some advantage out of it. But I feel like we have to be solid in the half court. We can't give up fast break. easy fast break buckets, and we have to be solid in the half court, have a good game plan in the half court to be able to beat the really good teams.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I guess just following up on some of the things that you've talked about a little bit is how you practice, especially with the foul component within practice.
How do you handle fouling in practice? You mentioned that sometimes your team might foul too much, or, you know, because of this aggressive style. But then the challenge is obviously to be, if you're talking about going to a pack, being a little less aggressive in the half court. So you could talk about how you manage that in practice and try and coach that.
Sure. I mean, I want my teams to understand what a foul is. This is the hardest thing as a coach. I mean, we foul more than I want us to foul, but there are times that you do want to foul. Maybe you have three team fouls and you're aggressive. You have a foul to give before the other team is in the bonus. So being aware of the foul, team foul situation, and understanding what is a foul, and also not overreacting to referees, because often, especially when you're tired, what you think you did and what you actually did are a little bit different. So we show a lot of video to show the beginning of the season, try to explain to the new players. Like I said, I usually have at least 9, sometimes 10 of our 12 players are new. So they have to, maybe they're new to the league, new to the team, new to Europe. So the game is reffed completely differently or very differently compared to the G League or college. And it's not just the traveling rule, it's hands on defense. And so I want them to understand what a foul is. And then, of course, when you're tired, and we're going to be tired again, hopefully our opponent's going to be more tired. So in a game, I might be frustrated that we're fouling too much, but oftentimes, you know, other teams will foul more than we do. Like they'll be completely done and they'll just lose it or stop defending. That's the hope, at least. Doesn't always happen. But it's really important to be disciplined with your hands and be disciplined with space, not to just run over people. We're not trying to steamroll people in the full court. And I've had players that got it quickly. And I've had guys who have, say, cornerback habits where they always have their hands out in front of them and they're looking to chuck people on defense and they get fouls just left and right and don't learn it. But it's our job as coaches, and we use the video. I'm doing that today. I have to head out to practice again here in a second. Today we're doing individual hand work on defense when guys get moving so that they don't have their hands out in front of us of them. And this is something that strength coaches need to buy into, assistant coaches need to buy into, the captain of the team, everybody. You got to control your hands on defense or you'll get called for fouls, especially in this league. Not so much in college. It looks, you know, when I watch college NCAA games, it looks like every possession's a travel. There's at least one travel, and every possession's about 10 fouls on defense because guys are whacking each other. Whereas we can play really physically with our chests. If we have our hands up, you can body somebody up. But for better or for worse, it's just reffed differently. And my guys need to know what a foul is. And we call it in practice. They get pissed in practice because I'm calling these fouls in practice. And yeah, that's the other thing about coaching is you're not always going to be the most popular guy, and especially if you're reffing your own practices, but that's the way it goes.
No doubt. Well, Coach, I can't thank you enough. I mean, to give so many unique insights into coaching and coaching with this style and with this philosophy, which again, I think is wonderful and unique. So thank you for sharing the game with us.
You're welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.